All right, welcome back. All right, good to see everyone. So, beginning of July, we're starting a new topic of this series on Dharma life or Dharma in daily life, and that's around relationships. Now, relationships, we know, can give us some of our deepest sorrow and also some of our deepest joy. And it can cause both our deepest wounding and also bring about some of our deepest healing. So tonight, I want to focus more on the sorrow side of things, the difficult side of things. How relationships can actually be a spiritual practice even through their difficulty, how their struggles themselves become teachers for us, and really about how we create that sense of other, that sense of someone who is outside of us, and that sense of creation of separation, which is really an essence of a Dharma question. And then in 2 weeks, we'll switch and talk about the joy side of things, how relationships help us to open our hearts to help it lead the spiritual practice of interconnection, of release, of separation, and how the sense of one emerges. If tonight is about creating the other, how we create that, understanding that, another way of saying it, creating the sense of suffering. 2 weeks, we'll talk about the one, the sense of release of that separation. The sense of releasing suffering and how we can experience union and connection through relationship. So I was reflecting on this topic, and first we have to kind of touch base on what we mean by relationships, because there's, of course, a wide range which is accompanied, covered by that. And we want to find a way that speaks to everyone, that has some way of connecting to everyone's life experience and life circumstances. Because sometimes, you know, we might talk about relationships from a romantic standpoint, but if those who are single may feel left out, talk about the parent-child connection, then there's a sense of those who are without children or children have left have a sense of being left out. So relationships can, you know, there's a parent-child, there's lovers, there's spouses, partners, boss, employee, co-workers, this whole range of different categories, siblings, anything I've left out, all encompassed by this term relationships. And I thought, instead of talking about those specific ones, which do matter, how they actually show up does matter, but much more in terms of the intensity of how we project that sense of otherness on those people, how we put someone else's face on them, how triggering they can be, and how we can have a long-term relationship with someone and have very little triggering come up, whether it's a parent, a child, a partner, or we could have a very short-term relationship that can be very triggering. This is this whole gamut, but I think opening to just, okay, how does relationship create that sense of other in us? How do we create the other as we relate to another person? Maybe a helpful way for us to tackle this topic. Now, this creation of this sense of other, you know, what is outside of you, you know, and somehow opposed to you in some way, the sense of separation. Again, in 2 weeks, we'll talk about how we create that sense of oneness, of interconnection. And really the intensity and the commitment to work through it varies based on that relationship. You know, we all have relationships that sometimes are harmonious and working well, and other times are very difficult and full of conflict. And of course, those particulars of those relationships do matter. You know, whether you're working with a relationship with a long-term partner, relating to a parent or a child, a sibling, a friend, you know, a stranger, all these different relationships do matter because it helps us how we navigate in the particular. But through all that navigation, there's the North Star that guides us. And that is that sense of creating the other, creating that sense of separation, of me versus you, me versus the world. So this overarching theme of creating the other. And when we relate to someone through anger, through jealousy, through fear, desire, envy, you know, any emotion that we can name, there's often a sense of, okay, I'm better than, I'm worse than, I'm the same as. Whenever we get triggered, that's that creation of the other, the sense of separation. And it's important to remember from a dharmic standpoint that the other is something that would be added to this relationship. In the essence, there is no other, but it's what other than what we create. We create that through our reactivity. Because if we're truly connecting with something, if we're fully connecting with something, the sense of other falls away. So to kind of give us a sense of this for a moment, let's do a little experiment right here in the middle of the talk. So just pick something that's in your environment, something that's benign, like I'm seeing like a water bottle or a cup that you can kind of gaze at. Something that's inanimate, that's not a pet or another person. And practice gazing at it and see if you can drop your normal assumptions, your normal projections around that. Drop even the label, the identification of that thing. Drop the ideas that get generated by that label. And dropping the sense that this is the name that we give things. This is, and all that goes with that name. This is the Nama Rupa, the name and form that we spoke of last year from the dependent origination. And as you're observing, so you're letting that thing become more and more uncluttered by your projection, by your assumption of it. So you're actually seeing it with maybe more clarity, more curiosity. It may become more vibrant in that seeing. At the same time, start to relax the sense of you who is observing it, start to fade, almost kind of drop to the background. So relax that position of you watching, that self-reference point, just soften that. There's a quality of even being unguarded, undefended against this, in my case, this paper cup. I'm not trying to defend or protect myself. I'm not trying to show I'm this kind of a person to the cup. The cup is letting me be just who I am. And so to whatever you're looking at, let it notice how it just lets you be who you are. Letting your heart become less defended, less guarded. Letting that relax the mind. And see if you can relax the sense of space between you and it. And let that start to fade. And relax any sense of doing around it, a sense of something that needs to be shifted or adjusted. And just let all that fade to the backdrop. And as you practice this right here with us, you may start to notice that sense of the object gets maybe closer, more intimate, kind of a sense of intimacy to it. There's a sense of you and it falling away, that there's just the cup. Being known somehow. The sense of separation starts to fade and fall. This kind of emerging that starts to arise. If you get the sense of this, rest there for a few moments. Notice how that sense of relationship, how that sense of relationship with is, how does that feel? Notice the sense of peace, of ease, of non-movement. And also there's a quality of vibrancy, of aliveness, of joy in this moment. There's a stillness that's very all permeating. At the same time, there's a fullness with that. It's an emptiness that's also very full and very rich. And they're doing nothing with, but connecting with the essence of that cup, with the essence of who we are. And do so, this is a practice of releasing name and form, releasing Nama Rupa. Now, still gazing at this inanimate object, this, in my case, this cup. Now bring forth the idea of cup, of cupness, the label to the forefront. And as you do so, let all the memories, all the ideas, all the projections also start to, upload with that. To start to load into the system, all the associations. And notice how easily those translate into impulses to act, to do something with. Now it's time to clean that up or to wash that or do something with it. We know what needs to be done in relationship to it. or what should have been done. And now notice that sense of relationship with that cup or that whatever object you're focusing on. Now you're clearly separate from it. You know where it is. You know where it's placed in your whole world. It's all ordered. And you know where you are in relationship to it. It's held within your understanding and your belief. Okay, so this is creating the other. So in this little exercise, I hope you get a taste of that releasing of the other, releasing of the story, releasing of the ideas, the name and form, and all the associations. So there's a direct, intimate connection with that object. And then seeing how we back it up, how we go the other way, reverse that, how we start to add one name after another, and the whole world starts to form around that. It's suddenly placed in this cognitive realm. So this is all with a inanimate object, an object that doesn't yell at you, doesn't say anything nice to you, just sits there without anything to do. Okay. And you can see how much we add to just that very simple thing. Now imagine what we do to another person with all their history and all their things we've experienced with them and all the things, people they remind us of. All that all gets loaded onto our interactions with them, the world of who we create around them and around us. You know, it's relatively easy to be unguarded with a water bottle or a paper cup. You know, it's not asking anything of us. We can let go of our defenses because it really doesn't have any opinions of you. Doesn't care what kind of haircut you have or what clothes you're wearing or anything about you. It doesn't project anything back on you. But humans project back on us. They have their own way of holding us as others. So we're kind of one othering, creating another othering. It's kind of back and forth. And we're sensitive to that. We sense that and we feel that. And then we react to that. And it creates more othering. We create this whole world around each other. That's why relationships have so much difficulty, because we're so often relating to our stories, our projections of the other person, and not that actual person, not actually who they are. And of course, the closer they are to us, the more we care about them, then the more intense they can be. Also, sometimes the more perfectly they trigger you, the more perfectly they remind you of your sister or your brother or your father or your mother. The more they trigger that, they match that in some way, that can also create that sense of otherness very, very strongly. And in doing so, just like with that inanimate object, we're creating a world around that person. We're really fixing that person in our minds. And we're relating to them through that projection instead of who they actually are. You start to get a sense of the problem. We're relating to someone through our projections instead of who they actually are. The Buddha said that, you know, we make this whole world from this 6-foot-long body. We project it from our senses. We create and project the world outward. This is what we discussed, explored so much detail last year in the Definite Origination series. And of course, this happens just in a very benign way. You just, if you look at someone on the Zoom call, someone that you know, you can, or even don't know, there's this whole projection you lay on them. You know, someone that you like, someone that you've had difficulty with, someone that you like how they look, someone you don't like how they look. Of course, this is this, you know, we're talking about the seeds of racism, of sexism, all these different isms that we do, this creating of the other. We see someone and we see them not as who they are, but through our projections. And this is the essence of what creates strife in our world. It creates violence and destruction and hatred and warfare. So this creating of the world, of course, gets amplified and really leveraged when we have relationship conflict. When we have interpersonal conflict. This creates this puts a lot of power and juice behind it, a lot of emphasis behind it. And this is the key way that we maintain it, is through the power of Nama Rupa, that sense of creating the story, believing in the story. just recently I had this little conflict with my wife over household chores and, you know, doing the dishes, and I was doing the dishes and didn't feel like I was appreciated the way I wanted to be. And she felt her own side of it and not being appreciated for the chores her did. And, you know, there's a different reasons why that is a touchy subject for us. But I found myself just kind of having this conflict just load up in my mind and body, feeling that resentment and the closeness of heart, and, you know, taking a walk in the park and just kind of mulling over this and having that conversation, that one-sided conversation with the other person that we so often do when we're triggered and reactive, that churning thoughts, the hurt feelings. And we maintain it. I maintained it by having that quality of isolation, of not actually connecting and talking, you know, at least for, you know, a while. We talked eventually and cleared that up. But as I was doing that, I was reflecting that I'm relating not to her, but to my story of her. And not even relating to her, but my story all around that whole, the family dynamics that I grew up with, or the archaic piece, all that was loaded on to that relationship. And of course, there's our, you know, the long years we've been married, all those pieces. But again, there's that loading on to the moment from my experience, from my projections, instead of actually connecting to who that person was. And it was from that place, though it was painful, it was very easy to maintain that, because I was, you know, in my own kind of world. This is part of creating the other. And this is the invitation in Dharma practices to pause and to, okay, let me connect with what's actually here, what's actually present. It's an example that kind of analogy to illustrate this. You know, sometimes I go through periods of having very vivid dreams, not very often, but occasionally, maybe. And I've gone on a retreat or been in a different environment for a while and kind of come home. And these dreams are often things like the wall is going to collapse, kind of impending doom in the room, like there's water leaking down. And sometimes they're so vivid, I wake up out of those dreams, but still in the midst of the dream. And I get up trying to do something about that wall falling down. And I find myself reaching and pushing on the wall. And after a few seconds, I start to realize, wait, the wall doesn't match my dream. You know, my dream is so vivid and so strong and has so much urgency. When I actually touch that wall, when I actually put my senses out into the room, I have to have this choice of recalibrating, say, okay, this reality that I'm touching doesn't match the vividness, what I'm believing in that dream. And I realize that, and then the dream is able to release that and relax. And let, you know, let the heart relax, the breathing calm back down. And this, I was thinking of this, but this is similar to what happens in relationship, that we have this projection, this idea, this story, which is a sort of a dream that we projected on reality. And yet we don't often check out to see what the reality is. In fact, if we don't, we can maintain it. We can keep it going. And so that's often a question that we have for ourselves. Am I willing to wake up from my dream to actually connect with how things actually are? In a relationship, that looks like sitting down and having a conversation at times, depending on the relationship. Some relationships, that's not appropriate, and we'll touch upon that in a moment. Like with my wife, sitting down and talking with her and hearing her side of that experience and hearing, you know, being able to speak mine and realize, okay, there's this kind of wounding, this tender area that gets triggered. And we can that way, through that connection, the actual connection, the story starts to fall away. The pain starts to fall away. And so the question is, are we willing to wake up from the dream? This is what Dharma practice is about, is learning to wake up from the dream that we project upon the world. When the Buddha talks about how we create the world with this 6-foot-long or 5-foot-long body, you know, he's saying that that's what creates this suffering. That's what creates dukkha. And learning to free the world from our projection, that's what is the cessation of that suffering. when we looked at the exercise with that inanimate object and releasing all the story, releasing that sense of separation and allowing it just to be seen by seeing itself. That's releasing the world from our minds, releasing the world from our projections. And so often we become proxies for each other, proxies, stand-ins for our own old wounding or archaic hurt, often relationship hurt. Even sometimes, you know, long-term relationships, we accumulate a bunch of that, those hurts. One therapist talked about this. He said that, I think it was Hendricks, he said that we get, you know, we fall in love with someone and then we, you know, in that first 6 months, it's all bliss. And then we finally wake up after that wears off and realize that we're laying in bed next to the worst characteristics of both our parents put together. You know, it's like this projection. We're trying to solve this archaic piece and we pick someone who's matches that perfectly and hopes to heal it. One of my personal therapists, he was, it was a man who's kind of a masculine man, but also very gentle. And he would, part of that therapy, people would project upon him, you know, their dad issues. And when that started to come to the front, he would take off his socks and show them his painted toenails. And he said, did your dad paint his toenails? Just to kind of break through that projection, waking up from that dream. And relationships offer that opportunity to see that dream, to see how we project upon the world in a very personal, very intimate way of our own suffering. Relationships bring that up like almost nothing else. That's why a lot of times when people become a monastic, they realize at some point they have to go back into that relationship. And sometimes they can do that in the monastic setting. And if they have the right group of people, willingness to really work on those issues, interpersonal issues. And others disrobe to come back into life to seek, okay, I want to see how that shows up, how relationships mirror that pain and give me that opportunity through that mirroring to heal it. Now, Rodney Smith often said that our wounding was done in relationships. So the healing also has to be done in relationship. So relationships in this way reveal both our wounding, our unresolved pain, you know, both for the intimate long-term relationships, but also those with strangers or with, you know, siblings or just friends. And we're constantly kind of triggering each other, sometimes big ways, sometimes low ways. And so whether or not you're in a long-term relationship, whether or not you're single, whether or not you have, you know, close friends or siblings or parents or children, this is constantly here. Just watch yourself go and interact with somebody and notice what you're projecting upon that person. That's creating that sense of other. They might say something that you feel that reaction in the body. That's why I think it's so helpful to focus on the body sensations, because that often reveals those subtle, almost easily overlooked reactions that arise. Those slight bumps, those slight sense of being slighted or disrespected or irritated. And that way they all becomes invitations to turn toward, to say, okay, what's here? That sense of learning, of curiosity, seeing how our pain is really revealed in relationship, and how that pain is really part of the landscape that creates that sense of separation, a sense of self. And that way it becomes an opportunity, really a gift for practice, a gift for deepening. And sometimes that gift, of course, we prefer not to be here. We prefer to, you know, not be rid of that person or that interaction. Remember hearing a story about Gurdjieff, a Russian mystic, and I guess there is some type of spiritual community that he was living in or leading. And there was one person that was really difficult. It was just annoying to everyone. Everyone just always be complaining about this person. And one day the person just decided to leave. And Gurdjieff ran after them and said, please stay. He said, well, everybody gets irritated. Everybody hates me. He said, yes, but that becomes the seed for their growth. That becomes the seed for their spiritual development, is that very conflict. Another teacher talked about it, again, living in a community, this time a Zen community, and complaining about the rubs. And her teacher said, it's like you're a bunch of potatoes being put into boiling water. And that's rubbing against each other. That's what finally skins the potatoes, gets that tough skin off, so they're all tender underneath. This is part of that tolerance for rub, for conflict, for being around other people. And I think as we merge into out of the pandemic, or at least a new, more free way of living with the pandemic, we can start to, you know, perhaps have that hesitancy about being with other people. You know, so I think it's important to practice that. You know, so, you know, again, be wise, be careful of your own health, your own particular circumstances. But if you, you know, you are healthy, you're vaccinated, you feel there's no overt reason, practice those edges. Okay, how can I be around other people? Because we get kind of conditioned that fear of others. This is also creating that sense of other. This shows us how we create the other. That's the kind of the key thing I want you to take away, is starting to notice those interpersonal conflicts is that creation of the sense of other, of separation. And this is the essence of suffering. This is the essence of the Buddhist path, is to see how we create that quality of separation, that quality of other. Relationships are a very powerful way to explore that. We can explore it, you know, with our breath, with sensation, with something like watching a tea cup or watching the sunset. There's all this sense of separation. And that's the illusion that the Buddha pointed toward, is let's see through that. Let's see through that as a reality, to see the underlying interconnection that's underneath that. Now, there's the reality of our different relationships, right? You know, we have to take that into account. Because some relationships are very committed. They have and actually depend upon vulnerability to deepen and grow. You know, it needs that vulnerability, that willingness to have those tender conversations for it to deepen. So with those, it's so helpful to have a person who's willing to listen to you and to hear you, and for them to be willing to share their own experience. So then you can start to release your story and connect with who they actually are. So these can hopefully be your partner, your spouse, dear friends, maybe a family member. Some relationships are inherently unequal by nature, like a parent or a child, a teacher to a student, a boss to an employee. And sometimes how deeply we share may not be appropriate. It can be boundary issues that come up from that. So we need to reflect, use discernment. Other relationships aren't so close. Like I may not go into a deep conversation with my mail carrier or the grocery clerk, but I can connect with that sense of otherness. I can still be aware of that in myself and how that shows up, how that generates a quality of how I talk, how I present myself, and practice releasing that. Practice being undefended. Other relationships have harm in them, have hurt, historical hurt, present hurt. And we want to be careful of imposing a spiritual ideal upon those relationships that I will suffer through anything, even through abuse, even through harm. And to realize that when further contact is harmful for you or harmful for the other person, to learn to work with that developing and understanding that otherness and safety. You know, learning when it's time to set boundaries, when to say no. So we have to discern what kind of relationship are we dealing with? What are we working with? What's the capacity of that person to communicate, to share, to talk? What's the commitment level of that relationship? What's the intimacy level? What's the right level of sharing? And also, is there any harm or danger that needs to be addressed, either from you or from the other person? So just to be realistic, not to have this assumption that, oh, we can meet anybody with complete openness and vulnerability. Sometimes we have to be discerning about that. And yet we can always work with that even in by ourselves, is how can I work with that sense of othering, creating the other around that person that causes so much difficulty. At the same time, be open to the relationship changing. Relationships can be very dynamic. And sometimes a shift in you creates a shift in the other person. The bottom line is, how do we create that other in relationship? And this is a primary way that relationships reveal the creation of self, suffering or selfing. Now, sometimes it's easier to recognize our patterns in relationship than try to, you know, jump right into releasing the sense of other. Instead of releasing the sense of separation, we can actually see and identify, get really familiar with those patterns, how they tend to show up, and start to train ourselves when those arise. Okay, here's a chance for me to actually turn toward them, to investigate, to grow and understand, to actually act differently, as opposed to our normal way, which is to reinforce and entrench. Now, part of the homework, I'm suggesting four areas in particular to look at around relationships. Again, we're looking at the grittiness, the struggle, the difficulties around relationships. In 2 weeks, we'll talk about the joys and the intimacy. And this is, I'm borrowing this from the Gottman's research. You know, the Gottman's are some of our Pacific Northwest researchers who study couples and had the permission to watch how they interacted and made notes on which couples stayed together and which ones didn't. And, you know, formed, okay, what couples, what do they do that works and what they do that doesn't work? And they came up with these four horsemen of the apocalypse, a very, you know, dramatic name. But when these operate in a relationship, you know, mostly it was toward committed relationships, you know, partner, spouse relationships. But also we can see them just in friendships or even with strangers, to start to notice when those arise and say, oh, let me pause there. Because that, when these arise, this is what creates that quality of story. So first one is criticism. When we find ourselves criticizing another person, that's creating that separation. It's creating the other very powerfully, very strongly. So we're working with that tendency to criticize. That's such a big piece of my own practice. You know, that's such a habitual piece that comes up almost without thinking. And if you're lucky enough, someone will give you that feedback of how painful it is to hear that. So when criticism arises, you know, pause, you know, feel the urgency, the opinionation. If you pause with it, you can see the whole story that you're creating and relying upon to criticize, that you know better, that they don't know better. There's all these pieces that come up. And yes, there may be something that feels really valid with that, but you come down to that question, okay, what's more important, my happiness or being right? Believing in the story, believing in that dream, or connecting with reality? Because I think most of us, you know, we criticize from a very narrow perspective, a very narrow set of assumptions of what's the right way to do things. Especially if you broaden that beyond, you know, from my own example, being a white heterosexual male, there's a whole, from a Western European background, there's a whole set of assumptions of what is the right white way to do things, the male way to do things. If I'm able to drop that assumption, the assumption I project by being a male, by being white, by being Western European, that allows so many different ways of being in the world to have their expression and their voice. And this is one of the pathways to true diversity, is to start to release that control, that story that we project upon others. Contempt is the next one. You know, contempt, that sense of, okay, I am better than you, are beneath me. That sense of, you know, just like not valuing them as a person. As you hear those words, you can feel how strongly you create that sense of otherness, a sense of separation. You can feel the pain as I hold that word. And when I feel that, you know, there's such a contraction, since a gulf that widens between me and the other person. And what's worse is it feels righteous. It feels righteous in that. Right? So again, it goes back to that story. Am I willing to release that story in order to connect? And when we invest and reinforce separation, we're reinforcing suffering, period. Reinforcing separation and creating the other is creating a sense of suffering. And this is the path to understanding suffering and releasing suffering, the freedom from suffering. Defensiveness, that sense of, you know, guardedness, of protecting ourselves from the other person. When this arises in a relationship, again, this is one of those four horsemen. It's so important to listen to that, to feel that defensiveness, to acknowledge it and pause. Because defensiveness is such a powerful protective quality. It has a kind of a fast, streamlined shoot into action, into reactivity and defending against. To pause and say, okay, do I really need to defend here? Can I be vulnerable? Is that appropriate with this person? Is it, there's a sense of safety, hopefully. You can practice the lack of defensiveness. You can see this in opinions and ideas. You know, when someone negates what you believe, and how we quickly rise up to defensiveness. And this is not easy practice, but at the same time, it really points to some of our deepest areas of struggle. And this is a very rich area of Dharma practice. And the final one is what the Gottmans called stonewalling. That sense of shutting the person out, not talking to them, disconnecting. That sense of isolation. And in that isolation, that's how we maintain that story. This is that example I said, that a day or so of feeling upset with my wife and, you know, not having the opportunity to talk, being busy with work, and just letting that story maintain itself and kind of holding myself apart from that connection. That was a form of stonewalling. I'm not going to talk about it. But I'm talking to myself plenty about it. And talking to my imaginary projection of my spouse. So bringing some attention these next 2 weeks to these four areas of criticism, of contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling, and seeing how that creates, how they all rely upon creating that story, that projection, and that sense of other. If you want to create a sense of other, practice these four. If you want to release the sense of other, practice noticing them and releasing them. This is really the art of truly listening. And when we listen truly in a deep way, without defensiveness, without criticism, without contempt, without stonewalling, without distancing, when we listen with a place of vulnerability, then we really let the other person in. At the same time, we're also letting ourselves out. There's just this beautiful way that it emerges. Going back to that exercise we did, releasing that sense of thing, of name, of form, of idea. So there's just us in that experience. Doing this with another person leads to such a beautiful connection. And again, you don't need to have a soulmate or a life partner. You can do this with a complete stranger, just a moment of connecting with them, just how they are. And as you leave that interaction, there's a quality of deep satisfaction. There's a sense of like, okay, that person actually was transformed by our interaction, and I was too, because I wasn't holding myself separate. So then everyone we meet has a way of transforming us, of changing us. So that listening deeply inward and outwardly, releasing into this wordless wonder of the other person and the wordless wonder of ourselves. And this way we can start to connect fully with them, who they actually are in this moment. Learn to dance their dance, and they can dance with us in our dance. This beautiful give and take of relationship. All right, thank you for your kind attention. If we could just sit quietly for a few moments. And before we go into some sharing, questions, comments, I'd like to just talk about the homework. And Ken, if you could post that in the chat. Thank you, Ken. So the practice and reflection for this week and next week. And so again, this is the first half of the month, is really looking at the difficulty, the struggle around relationships. The second half, we'll look at the joy and intimacy. And so we're particularly looking at how we create that sense of other, that sense of separation. That's triggered often by relationship conflict. It can be triggered in much more subtle ways, but we're kind of looking at the conflict aspect. So in particular, noticing those four horsemen of the apocalypse from Gottman's research of criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling. So all these are maintained by our unwillingness to release our story and our projections. Okay, so I'm hoping that you, when you find yourself going into one of those patterns of criticism, of contempt, of defensiveness and stonewalling, step back and notice the story that you're creating. And more importantly, the investment in that story. That way that you hold that story really dear. This is right. I want to hold this at the expense of my happiness, at the expense of my relationship. So practice recognizing what thoughts you're believing. You know, what am I believing here in this moment? Okay, we're not judging what you're believing, but just to notice it. Notice what is being believed. And if it's appropriate, if it's the right kind of relationship, practice releasing that story. So you can actually see, to connect with that other person so you can see through that story. And if it's someone that, you know, you don't have that level of connection with or intimacy with, practice releasing the story just the same. Just as you talk to them, okay, hear the story come up and you see through that to that actual person. I remember once when I was, had a friend who got in a bike accident and hit his head, and he started, you know, really his personality changed from that head injury and, you know, became more violent and more obscene and all those things. And so I heard this from other people. And then when I actually saw him again after that, I find myself talking to him and seeing all this story and projection and trying to see through the projection to actually see who he was. It was a really a powerful experience of seeing that projection, you know, and also the power of gossip and how painful that can be. And learning to connect through that to actually see who that person was. Learning to release the story. I mean, this is something we learn right from the beginning as a meditator. What's the difference between our idea of the breath and the actual experience of the breath? Seems very simple, benign, but it's meant to be kind of this gateway into taking it to this very deep level of relationship, see how relationships, we create the sense of other and story versus the actual experience of it. So releasing the story allows us to connect with what is actually here and frees the present moment from our past. Freeing the present moment from our past. Such a gift. And it leads to a peace, leads to a joy. All right, so I hope you enjoy that homework, and next week we'll have a chance to explore it and dialogue around it, and we'll be dialoguing, for those who are willing, in person. We'll talk more about that at the end. The next meeting will be in person, but there will also be an online option, so you're welcome to join us either in person or online. Again, more about that here at the end. So right now, let's see if there's any questions or comments about this topic of relationships, about your practice. So you're welcome to unmute, or Ken, if you could unmute somebody if you see their hand. Okay, Brooke.
Hi, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the difference maybe between releasing the story and ignoring the story. I guess I felt like I did try to work with this last year when we talked about it in the dependent origination, and I felt like I was getting better at recognizing that there was a story.
Yes.
And I felt like I was getting better at releasing it, but then I also just felt like I was ignoring the other person.
Yeah. So when you say ignoring the story, sometimes we ignore it because it's out of wisdom, and sometimes we're ignoring it because we don't want to deal with it. Which one are you talking about?
Well, that's a good question. Maybe I was ignoring because out of wisdom. I mean, I feel like I had a story, and then when I had investigated or talked about it with the other person, the story either matched reality or the story, it just didn't change. Nothing was released after talking about it or was acknowledged after talking about it. And so then rather than going into the story and being upset about it, I felt like I was able to release from it. But then I just felt like I was, I don't know, I felt like I was ignoring. Then it was still unsatisfying, even though I wasn't spinning in my head in the story anymore.
Yeah. I would say, just how you described that particular around that relationship or that interaction, that there's probably the superficial story was spoken of, but not the deeper story.
Yeah.
Not the proxies, the story that everything was proxy for. Mm-hmm. And that's because when you really touch upon that deeper one, then things shift. It's like, and it's often surprising, like, and how many times I've done this with my wife. It's like, I think I'm arguing about the dishes, but I'm really arguing about something much deeper, much more tender. And once I see that, it's like, oh, things suddenly shift and there's compassion for both her and for me. And it just, everything kind of shift around in that. And also just to be patient with it. Sometimes we're going, this kind of work is really going into this edge of delusion. You know, it's like this, you know, this level of just, and when I say delusion, it's like, this is the blindness. This is stuff that we just don't see, but it's really driving us. And so that willingness to be patient with it, to still kind of stay on that edge for a while, then sometimes, you know, maybe a few minutes, it might be a few days, it might be a few weeks or a few months, or sometimes a few years before we suddenly start to see through that. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, one simple exercise I'll offer is to do a little writing exercise. So just by yourself, like for 10 minutes, just write, okay, something about that experience, like, okay, I'm believing this. Okay. And then see what kind of gets elicited by that. And then write that same sentence again. Like it might be something like, you know, she's so, you know, narcissistic. Let's say that. And so you write that out and then you pause and let's see what comes up. And it might be, yeah, she is. And you let it come up again. You write it again. You write something else similar to the dyad exercise that we do, that you're basically giving yourself a self dyad, that you're kind of holding yourself to that inquiry. And often you do that, you may do that for a few days till something shifts and you see a deeper understanding, something that is not seen. The reason for the writing is it brings a quality of clarity and precision to it. And when we're just kind of thinking about it, we kind of dance around our normal pathways. But I think writing makes it a little bit more concrete.
Good. Thank you. That's helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. Now, the other side of it, that kind of the wisdom side of releasing the story is just when you just kind of pick it up, but you know, it's just empty. It just kind of, it's empty firing. And then you just, okay, just, this is just a habit, but it's more of a sense of like, okay, this is just not serving me. But if there's that sense of unsatisfaction, that shows that, you know, you haven't really, there's a deeper level that's not being touched upon. And opening to it, you'll see a deeper level of making the other, making the self. So thank you, Brooke. All right, who else has anything to share?
Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Thank you for your talk. Susan here. I'm reflecting on contempt, and I believe the Gottmans did a research project when they had couples come in and they were able to identify within minutes if that relationship had longevity based on some of these horsemen, and contempt is the only one I remember. And for me, that word is so loaded. It doesn't feel like righteousness or that quality of contempt almost appears to create the others. So it seems like the king or the queen of them. And I'm just wondering you know, how to explore that, because I have a feeling it's very subtle. And how can it be expressed subtly, and how to look for it? You mentioned righteousness, but I'm just wondering, I'm looking at it, for me, the word is almost, for me, it's just such a triggering and frightening word, close to hatred. It's so dehumanizing.
Yes.
Could you just speak to how that seems so loaded for me compared to the other ones?
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would wonder if that's something that you've experienced, is having people express contempt toward you. And that's part of why that has such a strong charge. Because sometimes those charges, it's like, you know, especially something I just don't, you know, understand how I, you know, how to experience, you know, how I feel contempt, but you may know what that feels like to receive it. And so start to, you know, unpack it that way. So, okay, well, you know, who has felt contempt toward me? Can I, you know, can I take that in? Can I not take it in, but, you know, internalize it, but to actually acknowledge it, to kind of let it be, let aired out a little bit, like and something that's old and musty, you know, let that kind of be felt and released a little bit through your loving kindness, through your metta, through your observation of it. And then start to, and that way you can start to notice, that starts to discharge around it. So you can start to notice, you know, those who you hold in contempt. You know, there's probably, you know, most of us, there's some area that we really do believe or we're more righteous about. You know, I think in this, there's more subtle ways we can look at this, but maybe one that may be more obvious is around intellect, you know, around education. I think especially in the kind of a lot of the Dharma group, you know, we tend to be more educated and more intellectual, and we maybe look down upon someone who's not as intellectual, just throwing that as an option. Or, you know, maybe someone who's, you know, who's done their work or hasn't done their work. There's so many different ways that shows up. So you might notice it more to the subtle qualities of that. So first, you know, work a little bit in healing the own contempt you may have experienced. And then start to notice those qualities, those subtle qualities. And, you know, if that's not a big one for you too, that's, you know, work on the other ones. Yeah, because they all kind of come from the same quality of other. And that's just a list to start, get you started. You may have a better set of four or a better way that you create the sense of other. And you can share that next week. All right. Thank you, Susan. All right. Anyone else have anything to share or add?
Tim, you talked about the relationship with the other as also recognizing their projections on you. And their projections could be really positive. You might want to nurture that. I don't know if that's a thing or not. But also, yeah. It could be neutral.
Yes.
And we may not always know our projections unless somebody tells us or we discover it ourselves. You know, the inner voice telling us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that sense of being projected upon and the positive side of it, it's certainly, I was going to say it's less destructive, but I wonder if that's true. You know, sometimes we hold people up to a standard that they have trouble living up to. We put them on pedestals. You know, it's from a dharmic standpoint, we're really looking at how do we meet that person without adding anything to them. They're adding that positive or negative, but seeing just how they are.
I think what I was wanting to hear from you was that, for example, on the plane back, I sat beside a young woman who was so respectful and so open, and to sharing, to exchange gifts of insight. And that's not possible if you're rejected by somebody. And so I think that's an example of the benefit of promoting that acceptance.
Yes. Yeah, I think absolutely that's, I think that was an example of, you know, both you and her on that plane trip. You dropped your defensiveness, your posturing, and you just were sharing. And that's
she dropped. I mean, it has to be two way. It can't just be.
Yes.
You have to start with one, but it has to happen two way.
Yeah. So that allowed a deeper connection, right? You actually were able to share things which are important to both of you. Yes, I don't know if I'm quite getting at your question, Stephen, but that's it sounds like that's more.
I was just example wondering if it was the same thing, the attachment. You have to recognize the suffering, right? Mm-hmm. But the attachment to the positive is the same as the projection of a negative.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And you often see that attachment when things change, yeah. Right? So, you know, it's been said that attachment will cause suffering. Sometimes it's while that attachment's happening, if it's attachment to something painful. If it's something pleasant, the attachment comes when it ends. I want to put you back in that place. I want you to stay in that role or stay in that projection. Well, if there's not attachment, then there's just the delight of meeting that person. And then when they, next time you meet them, if you do, there's, okay, how are they in this moment? Yeah, but absolutely, we can have a positive projection on the person that holds them in a certain other just as much as a negative one. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Stephen. All right, anyone else like to share anything?
I was just thinking about perception, and when you do 10-day retreats and you don't speak to somebody, and you realize in the last 2 days that you get to do speak, and you just, that's when I really realized how I project things. They were nothing like I saw that, you know, it was amazing. I projected somebody because of the way they looked or they carried themselves.
That's right. Yeah, that's a great, great lesson, you know, for those who've gone on retreats that you do create the story making still goes on, even though we're not talking and interacting in the normal ways. You know, we're still sitting next to each other, walking, cleaning together, all that stuff. But there is a whole story that we create. And I think it's really eye opening when we realize, oh, wow, that was completely imagined. One example of that is the Vipassana romance. You know, we fall in love with someone and we marry them and then divorce them all in the space of never speaking one word to them. It's like there's this ongoing projection. And the mind is going to continue to do this. You know, it's just how conscious we can become of it and how quickly we can recognize that. That's really the helpful piece there. I mean, I guess we can start to purify more and more the more we explore this, that we don't project automatically, but it still comes up, you know, for a lot of arenas. But we can start to recognize that. And really, I think the cleanest way to recognize it is that really felt sense of separation, of sense of distance of that. And it could be a distance created by aversion, or it could be a distance created by craving, like Stephen was talking about. But it's still, we're holding them in a certain light. And it's so helpful to realize, just like you did when you talked to that person, this is not the reality of what I placed on them. And it's each time we do that, we realize, oh, yeah, that's a reminder. My thoughts of things are not the actual things. They're just pointing, sometimes accurately, sometimes vastly inaccurately. All right, thank you. All right, maybe one more, then we have some important announcements.
I don't see. Was Deb going to make the announcements tonight?
Yes, Deb was going to make the announcements.
Let's see her.
Yeah, she's here. Okay, so if that's everybody. So Deb, did you get that email from Susan? Okay, great. So I'm going to turn it over to you, and thank you all for your engagement tonight, and look forward to seeing you next week, either in person or online. And Deb will talk all about that, and hopefully see you this weekend with Rodney's day long and fundraiser.
Okay. Thank you, Tim. Thank you very much for your teachings tonight. I do have a, first of all, my name is Deb Slavinsky. I'm on the board of directors for SIMS. And I am making announcements tonight, and I would agree that they are important announcements because, well, you'll hear. Here we go. So the first announcement I'm going to do first, because it's the shortest of them, which is that on Saturday, July 24th, Tim Giles' intro class, which he has been teaching this summer, will have its culminating day of mindfulness, which is a day of practice, which everyone is welcome to attend. We do ask you to register for this on the website. The students will be there. It's always nice to have practiced people come to help steady the group and to just lend some reassurance and some comfort and some welcoming into the Sangha. So that will be Saturday, July 24th, 9 to 4:30. Tim, have you decided if you're going to hold some of that day in person as well as virtually?
I think I've decided we're going to keep it online because I think most people are online in that class and they're just making it easier for everybody.
So that will be a Zoom day of practice then. So that's July 24th. The next announcement has to do with our capital campaign, which is underway. A new SIMS Grow Our Dharma Roots fundraising campaign is underway to help raise $150,000 for a new spiritual home for SIMS. As you may already be aware, a future vision for SIMS is unfolding at University Friends with a 10-year full-time lease in the first story of their building. The final design is still being worked on and will allow SIMS to beam the Dharma far and wide so that all can love and access the Dharma from afar. Yet it cannot reach full maturity without your care and support. There is a special fundraiser and day-long this coming Saturday, July 10th, with beloved SIMS founding teacher Rodney Smith. All donations raised Saturday will be matched by generous donors. I'll say that again, every bit of money that is raised Saturday will be matched. So please contemplate making a donation on Saturday. The day starts at 9 and goes until 4:30. We have a special fundraising committee right now with 8 members and growing, has been created for this capital campaign to raise $150,000 and create new and exciting ways for the Sangha to get involved and raise funds. To donate now and to learn more about the remodel project, Ken has put a link in the chat, I know already. So please refer to that. Please go to the website and learn more about the project. It's very exciting. You can see photos of the architect's drawings. And if you'd like to donate or become involved in the fundraising campaign itself, this is your opportunity. The next two announcements I want to make are a little lengthy, and I ask your forgiveness for taking the time for it, but they really are pretty critical and also very exciting. So the first part of this announcement is that the SIT next Monday will take place in person and on Zoom at UFM. We are going to return to in-person SITs at UFM starting next Monday, which is July 12th. Everyone knows COVID-19 guidelines have been changing rapidly in the state of Washington, and these are the guidelines that we are putting out for our Sangha right now. First of all are welcome to attend our in-person events. Everyone is welcome to come in person. We would encourage mask wearing if you are just simply more comfortable wearing a mask for any reason. And I'll be there next Monday and I might have a mask on just because, you know, it's been a long time and I just might need to have a mask on. So don't take that personally if you see me with a mask on next week. So if you just feel more comfortable wearing a mask for any reason, please wear a mask. If you have not been vaccinated, we would encourage you to wear a mask. If you have any respiratory symptoms at all, you're encouraged to wear a mask. If you're immunocompromised or you're in a household with someone who's immune compromised, we encourage you to wear a mask. If you're in a household with children under the age of 12, we encourage you to wear a mask. But all are welcome to attend. And all of our Monday night meetings will be hybrid, meaning both in person and on Zoom. And so you can always attend on Zoom. It's always an option. We'd like you to know that the Friends, who are our landlords in this building, they have lifted all COVID restrictions at this time. They will be in the near future developing some infection control guidelines, and we will pledge to follow them, whatever they are. We'll receive those specifics soon, we think. But at the meantime, we believe that what we're encouraging people to do now will keep you safe and enable you to be physically in Sangha with us with a degree of personal comfort. That choice is entirely up to you about what you do and how you do it. We will not collect contact details from in-person attendees. Instead, we're going to encourage you to download something called the Washington Notify app on your smartphone, which is what the state is using to do contact tracing if that is necessary. And some of you may have heard about a liability waiver that we asked people attending Tim's intro class to sign, and we will do away with that immediately as well. You will not need to register in advance to come on Monday night. There is no maximum cap of people who can come. As many people can come as would wish to. So we're still experiencing a pandemic. We still want to be cautious and be safe and take precautions so we can remain safe. But these guidelines obviously are very exciting and important, and we're very excited to be sitting together in Sangha next Monday. This is accompanied by some security guidelines that the Friends would ask us to be aware of and to follow. And so I'm just going to read this statement, and I'll talk more about this next Monday too. So the security situation at the meeting house has changed. This is not specifically related to COVID, but it is a new requirement. The outer wooden gate between the bike racks and the courtyard must now always be either closed or attended by a person. This is to make sure that only people coming to our event or otherwise with a valid reason to be in the building come in. So what that means is that volunteers will be in the building starting at 6:30 to ready the building for the sit. The gate outside will be locked. The big wooden sliding courtyard gate will be locked while they are doing that. We will begin to let people in at 6:45. And a volunteer will at that time open the gate, slide it open, and they will be positioned there until about 7:10. And everybody can come in, take a seat in the worship room, and that person will wait there until 7:10. The sit starts at 7, as you know. We will wait until 7:10. And about at that time, the gate will be pulled closed and locked. And the volunteer will take their seat in the worship room. So this means, in effect, that latecomers past 7:10 or thereabouts will not be able to gain access. We are not allowed to leave those doors open any longer for people to arrive late. We are asked to secure the perimeter of the building, if you will. We may be able to work out a way in the future to, you know, for you to be able to text a volunteer to be let in if you're late. And we just haven't worked out those details yet. Those are the guidelines right now. Once you go through the wooden gate, you turn to your immediate left and use that door from the courtyard into the building. all those other courtyard doors are going to have to be kept locked and closed. We'll have signage to help you with this. There will be volunteers around to guide you. And when the sit is over, kind of in reverse, the volunteer will come, pull open the gate, stand there and wait until all the yogis have left, and then lock it up again, close it up so that they can then put things away and get the building tidied up and locked down for us to leave. So this is a long-term requirement as long as we're using the worship room. It's not associated with pandemic responses, but it is, as the friends say, a change in the social culture of the neighborhood that they are responding to. So I wanted you to be aware of that so that you knew about these changes before you came. And we will talk about these more next week when you experience them. But the friends, in my experience, are very kind and compassionate people. And they're also very pragmatic people. And they want the building to be safe. They want the environment to be safe. They want everyone to be safe and secure. And so these are steps they feel necessary to take. And we will be in accordance with that. So that's the end of my announcements, except to please remember the Donna Baskets, for Sims, and the Donna Baskets for the teacher. And I see a text that says, if we have questions about, if we have questions about the new space, who do we ask? You're welcome to email volunteer at seattleinsight.org. That will come to my attention. I'm happy to answer those questions. You can certainly send those questions to me. I'm happy to dialogue with you about that. So thank you very much for your attention to those announcements.
Thank you, Deb. Yeah, we're all excited to get back in person. I've been teaching since mid-June, and it's going very well. And those security things are really, really easy to get through. We've had a few minor theft attempts, so they're trying to keep that a little more buttoned down. So it's not a big deal, and look forward to seeing those of you in person who are willing and those online who like to stay there.